said, for the last 4 years, I have been the head of chaplaincy at Peterborough Prison, and before that worked in various jails in various capacities. So I've been around the criminal justice system for quite a number of years. Peterborough is an odd prison, to say the least. For those of you who didn't know that Peterborough had a prison, it's because it's only 7 or 8 years old. For those of you who know Peterborough, it's built on the old Baker Perkins site and has brought an awful lot of employment to the city. But that's not what makes Peterborough unusual. What makes Peterborough unusual is it's the only dual-gender prison in the country. Essentially, we have two prisons on one site, a male estate and a female estate, and although they never mix, it means that our staff minister to, care for, and ensure discipline for both sides of the prison. What also makes it unusual, and I'm not going to go into this massively this morning, but if anyone would like to at coffee time, they're welcome to. It is unusual because Peterborough is a private prison. It's run by a company called Sodexo, which we should never fail to remember or be naive to. Private prisons are run for the financial gain of their shareholders, and that raises big ethical questions about how much people should be entitled to profit from prisoners' incarceration, or to put it on another side, how better that estate can be managed for the individual prisoner. As I say, maybe we can touch on that over coffee. But the sort of prisoner that Peterborough cares for on the female estate, we have a young offender wing and we lock up regular women offenders. The female estate is very different to the male estate in the prison service, because whereas the prison estate, you have different categories of prison depending on the risk that that prisoner would pose to society if they escaped. And on the male estate, that runs A through D, A being the most highest security. In the female estate, they don't categorise women like that. The only two categories of female estate prison are open and closed, and Peterborough is a closed prison, meaning you can't walk in and out, and it's our job to ensure that they don't. And so we have young offenders and we have regular female offenders. We also have a very interesting mother and baby unit. So that if, as a female offender, you commit a crime and are sent to prison and you are pregnant or you have a child under the age of 18 months and you will be released before that child reaches 18 months, you can apply to go onto the mother and baby unit so that the child is with you in prison. Again, quite a strange environment to be in. On the male estate, we are a Category B prison. We're a local prison, which means that everyone who gets sentenced in the Cambridge and Peterborough area will go through Peterborough to be assessed and then serve their time in Peterborough, or if they're going to be in prison for an awful long time, get shipped off to another jail where they have interventions that are specifically targeted at long-serving prisoners. So it's a busy prison. We hold just under 1,000 prisoners, about two-thirds male and a third female. And it's a very busy prison, having this element of being a local prison that sees people through the doors. And so we'd typically have just short of 5,000 new receptions into the prison every year. It's a wonderful place to see what prisoners and who prisoners really are. We're very lucky, I think, in the chaplaincy department, or we were, as Fraser said, I'm now at Queen's, not in the prison. The chaplaincy department is a brilliant place because we get to spend time with people and we get to offer them some pastoral and spiritual care. But more than that, we get to learn from prisoners. The chaplaincy within any prison has the legal responsibility for pastoral and spiritual care. There are huge privileges with that. I think from the spiritual, the privileges are often that, and this is something that the church doesn't always like to admit, but biblically, you cannot escape the fact that God often communicates with those whom society rejects in a way that he doesn't communicate with the people who go to church on a Sunday morning. Certainly not how he communicates with members of the clergy. Normally, the religious leaders are the last people to know about God's wisdom. And actually, those who are oppressed are those who know it very well. Quite often, when I was doing some work at Winchester Prison down on the south coast, and I was being trained by a fantastic priest there who looked after the chaplaincy, quite often we would have religious groups writing to us saying, "We would love to come into Winchester Prison and bring Christ to your prisoners." To which Terry Lane, the coordinating chaplain, would always say, "Of course, you are very, very welcome," knowing that if nothing else, they would walk through the door and, to their amazement and often consternation, they would find that he is already there. And he is already there in the hearts and the minds of those who are oppressed, and he is already there in a more profound way than most of these organizations understand Christ. And for us in chaplaincy, a lot of people imagined that it would be us teaching the prisoners something about reforming their life, the good deeds that was expected them as a Christian, and imparting in them not just a little bit fear of hell to motivate their change of life. Whereas actually, the privilege of chaplaincy was in hearing and responding to some of this very deep and great wisdom that the prisoners had. Another huge privilege of working in prisons and with offenders is that they're not afflicted by something that most of us probably are. When I was serving my curacy down in a place called Romsey, just north of Southampton, beautiful, lovely, middle-class, leafy green market town, what I learned very quickly as a new cleric is you could go up to a parishioner in the street and you could say, "How are you?" And short of the four horsemen galloping down out of the clouds, the normal response would be, "Fine, thank you." Which, as a pastor, makes life quite difficult. It especially makes life quite difficult when then the straw that breaks the camel's back, you're then flooded with 20 years' worth of unexplained and undealt with pastoral need and hurt. Paradoxically, prison is the most honest place that you'll ever come across. If you ask a prisoner how they are, they will tell you. You probably need about 20 minutes, but they will tell you, warts and all. They will tell you about every aspect of their life. They will be honest about it, and it will always end up with, "So what are you going to do to help?" So from a pastoral point of view, prison is a wonderful place to work, and always has benefits. There are some challenges, though, and I believe that some of the challenges in prison ministry come mostly from the outside world. And the challenges that we would come across would be prisoners' perceptions of the faith communities that they may have come for or observed on the outside and bring that impression into prison. One of the things that prisoners learn very quickly, and it's the same within in most institutions, be it a military base, a prison, a college. When people turn up new and fresh, they find it a little bit weird and a little bit odd to see a priest walking about for most of the time and just being a part of that institution. And we all probably do that. I still, when I walk through town with my wife, and if we see a vicar, think, "Oh my God, look, there's a vicar." You don't often see that. Whereas people in institutions get to know chaplains being around an awful lot. And that gives us an opportunity to address some of the preconceptions that prisoners would have about faith. Whereas the majority of time, because in chaplaincy we went to see every single new reception within 24 hours of them turning up at the prison, normally what would happen is you'd knock on the cell door, unlock it, they would look, they would see the dog collar, and they'd say, "No, it's all right, mate, I don't believe in all that." And actually, they come with this huge understanding that the only thing that we as faith communities want to do is sign them up to be like us. Which surely cannot be what we are about if we're modelling Christ, if we're valuing everyone as their own individual. And so I suppose my challenge, or the first part of my challenge, as you as a congregation look at how you may respond to ex-offenders, is about how would you deal with an ex-offender if they walk through the door now? One of the interesting things that we had, I prepared 4 or 5 of the female offenders last year for confirmation, which is a big deal. And it's a big deal for me, because most people who would come and either want to be baptized or confirmed or even married in prison, I would say wait until you're out. Because actually a big part of that is being welcomed into a community. You are not being just baptized, you are being baptized into the church, and it's the church's responsibility to look after you. Exactly the same with confirmation. And the reason that we did confirmation class for these women last year is because they will never be released from prison. They are there for their whole lives, and they know very well that they will die in prison. And so it is for those people who we prepare for confirmation and for baptism, and we even look at weddings to their partners on the outside. These women had nothing to lose and yet wanted to be welcomed into the community of faith. And we went through all the confirmation classes, and sure enough, we laughed together and we cried together, and it was a huge privilege to be a part of that. Then the bishop emailed me as he was getting ready to come in and take this confirmation service. And he said, "I'd just like to know a little bit about each of these women. Not about their offences, but about their character and how they perceive the church that they are joining." And so we had a session where I simply asked them, "What is your impression of the church on the outside? The wider church, the universal church, the Catholic church that you'll be joining?" And the one word that came up over and over and over again was cold. A lot of churches, you probably do shiver in and temperature cold, but they, of course, meant something a lot deeper than that. They meant cold as in they didn't feel that they fitted in, and it wasn't a place of warmth and acceptance. Cold because when they've been into churches in the past, they felt sort of ostracized, not because of the way they look or their age, but because they weren't part of the church. So I suppose that's the second challenge for you as a congregation. How is it that you're going to be welcoming? One of the things I always encourage churches to look at, if nothing else, is about how someone who is completely unchurched would feel going to one of their services. I was really encouraged, and this could have been embarrassing if you hadn't done it, Fraser, but I was really encouraged turning up and the service being very clear what we had to do. I didn't become a Christian until I was 18, 19, when I was at university the first time round. And I remember very, very well, in the same way that the prisoners were talking, I remember very well being absolutely terrified walking into new churches, because I was convinced that I would stand up or sit down at the wrong time and everyone would know that this is the least holy person in the church. And that fear is about the cold reception. That fear is about not knowing what to do and not feeling accepted. And so just right from the very word go, about how services are taken, how you're received at the door, how those of you who have been here for an awful long time will know and will spot someone who you don't know and how you respond to them, which is incredibly important. So returning to our prisoners, and I'm going to use over the next couple of minutes some of the prison language, which stick with because there's a reason that I want to talk like this. So within prisons, one of our main responsibilities, for me the most important responsibility that we have, is putting in place interventions within the prison to reduce reoffending. Interventions are any sort of interaction or course or what have you, to help offenders address their offending behaviour with the hope of reducing their reoffending rate. We have them because they have already offended. We're not in charge of society's wider responsibility to stop someone offending in the first place. We've got them because they are there. And so we put in interventions to reduce reoffending. These are delivered through so that we can resettle prisoners in a way that reduces reoffending. And I would just say, for those of you who haven't already spotted her, this lady here in the black is my wife, and she's the resettlement manager of Peterborough Prison, and she'll be around afterwards to answer any questions as well. So we are in the business of resettlement to reduce reoffending. And there are some things that we know in the prison service need to happen, and if we can deliver that, the risk of reoffending is reduced. And if we don't deliver that, then we know that it increases. And so we know that if we can provide prisoners soon to be ex-offenders, education, training, or employment on release, they are less likely to reoffend and come back to us. We know that if we can provide an ex-offender with housing and housing provision, they are much less likely to reoffend. We know that if we can, with prisoners, maintain their family ties whilst they are with us, and so they have family ties when they're released, they are less likely to reoffend in the future. We know that if we grow a prisoner's self-confidence and esteem and their belief in themselves, and this is a massive one on the female estate of the prison, about self-worth. If we can grow that in people and show them that they are a valid and important individual and give them those skills, we know that they are less likely to reoffend in the community. We know that if we can be honest with prisoners and they can be honest with us about their offending behaviour, be it drugs, alcohol, trafficking, whatever it may be, if we can be honest with that and honest with the triggers that put them in situations that therefore make them offend, and we can tackle that, and if we can be honest about that and bring in interventions that can tackle that, they will be less likely to reoffend. And we also know that if a prisoner is someone of faith and we can place them into a supportive faith community, they are less likely to reoffend. And so just to take the last one, what sort of faith community do we imagine would support someone to stop them from reoffending or reduce the rate that they may reoffend? We want to try and enable prisoners to find somewhere that is warm, that is accepting, that has a mechanism for confidentiality as prisoners work through their issues that make them ex-offenders. And I think we also want a community that's honest. I think from what I've seen, an awful lot of people don't want to name the elephant in the room when an ex-offender comes to church, whereas they have lived with their offence, they know their offence, they're honest about their offence, and they've come from an environment where they have to be very open about their offence to receive the care that they require. And so I'd encourage you that if you go down the line of welcoming ex-offenders into your church, not in a public or a crass way, but don't be scared to talk to them about their offence and to give them an opportunity to articulate how it is that they should be trusted within society. They will be more used to it than you will be. So if the last 4 years at Peterborough have been around understanding resettlement of prisoners into an environment where they are freer, I would like to suggest for each and every one of you something about your personal spirituality. All the way through the Bible, we understand both explicitly and implicitly that we as individuals live within a sort of spiritual prison within ourselves. There is part of us that is locked up because of our past, because of what we've done, because of the times when we have failed. Many would say because of our precondition with the fall, going back to Genesis. And I would be lying to say that personally, in my spiritual life, there are times when I feel incarcerated, times when I feel imprisoned by the failings that I have in myself and that I continue to do time and time again. And I would wager that there's not one person in this congregation who, if they're very honest about their lives and honest about how they respond to the spiritual big questions that are asked of them, don't get it wrong sometime. That's why every single week, coming to communion, we make our confession and seek God's absolution. But surely the whole point of our lives and the spiritual journey that we're on is, in a sense, going through that resettlement process for the soul, taking us from our imprisoned, very human, earthly existence into the freer, taking up Christ's offer and opportunity to make us ex-offenders and be welcomed into his wider kingdom. And maybe the prison service has something to teach us as we look at our own spiritual journeys. And this is why I wanted to use prison language earlier on. What sort of intervention in your spiritual lives will reduce your reoffending? I wonder within our faith lives, when we're looking at growing ourselves and our ability and our strength to be the person that we should be, I wonder what education, training, and employment means. How do we learn about our faith to deepen it? What do we participate in to gain experience of the faith? How is it that we're using our lives and our employment and the majority of our waking hours during the week to live out our faith? What is it about maintaining our family ties, and who is it in our family that we know will strengthen us to reduce our risk of reoffending and taking us back to that spiritual prison that we often find ourselves in as a result of sin? where is it within our self-confidence and our self-esteem that may end us up in tricky situations where we re-offend what we have already confessed before God? And what is it that needs tackling in our lives, i.e. what we have to be honest about and seek help for? What is it, the offence that we do? What is it, the triggers that put us there? What is it that we need to actually admit so that someone can help us to reduce our spiritual reoffending so that we can resettle the soul? That's the list of interventions that I had, barring one, and it's the last one. Placing in a faith community. What is it that you get from St. Edward's? How secure do you feel here? Is it a supportive community, or are there parts that you can get involved with to make it more of a secure community? Because we know that being part of a supportive faith community reduces the risk of reoffending, and that surely has to be the same for our spiritual lives as it does for those of offenders. And so my challenge this morning is to learn something from the prison service, because we've been doing it for an awful long time. Look at your congregation, but most importantly, look deep within. Be honest about the fact that you keep reoffending, because we all do. But what is it in those interventions that may help you in the future?